The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week's podcast, we speak with Google's head honcho of YouTube, Hunter Walk. We'll also be looking at the future of the search giant as it faces an antitrust investigation, a new chief executive, and a better than anticipated uptake of its open source mobile platform, Android. We'll also be listening out for what Amazon's most recent announcement about its cloud storage service means for the music industry. And joining me to pick these stories apart with a fine-tooth comb is The Guardian's digital media correspondent, Jemima Kish, and The Guardian's technology editor, Charles Arthur. Welcome to you both.
Well, hello there.
Hello.
We've missed you over the past few weeks. Where have you been gallivanting to? Jemima, you've been away.
I was in Texas, and then I was recovering from Texas. And
is Texas not away?
Been around.
I would say it's pretty far
that was
away.
Ages ago.
Quite a long bus ride for me, surely.
And did you were looking recently for places to, places you could rent, places
disconnect.
You could vacation in order to disconnect. Have you found anywhere?
I went glamping. It's a very Guardian phenomenon. I went to Rye, to Swallowtail Hill Farm, where they had beautiful yurts and saw owls and heard woodpeckers. And at one point there was a buzzing noise, and my boyfriend thought it was his phone. It was actually a bee. He'd forgotten that he didn't have his phone.
That's my bee ringtone.
Now, you had actually been searching for places that advertise themselves as completely disconnected. Was this one of them?
Kind of. I mean, I think the phenomenon of luxury hotels that proactively say, no, we don't have wireless and there's a very bad mobile signal, that hasn't really reached the UK yet, whereas in America and Latin America, that's starting to be a sort of luxury holiday. People can't get me here. So camping was the only option, really.
It is. It must have been very cold. And Charles, where have you been? We've missed you.
I was away last week, having a week off, because I'm working on my book. I'm writing a book about Microsoft and Apple and Google and all their business battles down the years.
And when do you expect publication?
Next year. But it has to be delivered by middle of this year. So I'm writing. I have to say, I'm just fascinated by some of the things I'm finding out. You know, earliest uses of the word Google as a verb in a publication.
Which was? Were you gazumped
yourself? New York Observer in 2000.
Ah. And really aggravated Yahoo, I seem to remember.
To Yahoo doesn't really have the same meaning, does it?
Yeah, you don't Yahoo something, do you?
No.
Unless that now means to balls it up.
Well, pulling this back to the point, Charles, I'm sure that we will discuss your book in the future. But for the rest of you, keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Google is currently in a remarkable transition period. Battle-worn from the latest antitrust investigations, the search giant is also warping in the shift of its CEO as co-founder Larry Page takes his place on the bridge, left absent by long-term business collaborator Eric Schmidt. Now, Charles, let's tackle the latest headlines first. What is happening with the European Commission's antitrust investigation?
Well, the EC in February sent out questionnaires to all sorts of advertising and search and related companies, asking them about the minutiae, and they really were very minute details of how well the advertising market worked, the search market worked, the search advertising market worked. How was it done? Did they have the data they wanted? Were they able to get it out of Google? And they weren't sort of drawing any conclusions. They were simply, you know, asking the questions. So they're gathering that all together. They have to work through all the responses from all the companies and all the countries around the EC. Although the sort of early signs are that Google probably won't have to face a proper antitrust lawsuit, that the EC isn't going to go after them on the question of search advertising.
That in and of itself, that corpus of data sounds phenomenally fascinating and would be hugely valuable, I imagine, to the private sector. Does the EC, as an aside, have any intentions of publishing that, making it public?
I don't know. Actually, I mean, I suppose it could be very, but I think also that it would be provided confidentially, and that it would be the sort of thing that gets locked up into dusty EC filing cabinets and things, because, you know, they'd be giving away certain data about how their companies work. So doing it. It's very commercially confidential because the EC has to be able to get at that sort of stuff to see whether the markets are working or not. That's EC. In the States, at the same time, Google is planning a big billion-dollar takeover of a company called ITA, which is flight information. And that is being questioned. They're looking at whether that's going to require some sort of antitrust or anti-competitive investigation. And after that, Bloomberg's now reporting today that the Department of Justice is querying whether Google needs to be investigated over its search. Google is pretty robust about this. It says if people want to go to a different search engine, they're all over the place. They're all over the web. You want to have a different search engine? Not a problem with us. So they're pretty straightforward about it.
You couldn't hear that, but my eyebrow raised there. Oh, yes, by all means, go to another search engine. But, you know, but people won't because it's in the lexicon, isn't it, Jemima? People will simply go to Google because they want to Google something.
Yes, I haven't yet found myself wanting to Bing something.
This is interesting, given that Microsoft is apparently enmeshed in this as well.
Well, yeah, Google has not wasted any time in reminding people that as far as the EU case goes, it was a Microsoft subsidiary that was one of the original complainants in the case. Which makes it sort of smell a little rather of sour grapes, you know, at the time when Microsoft... in terms of its hold over the tech industry, is in decline, and Google is all-powerful and has a huge amount of money in the bank. Was it $36 billion in cash sitting in the bank?
Though equally, it was a British search company called Foundom, which had one of the bigger complaints, which is about the placement of Google's own properties in search results. And Foundom did some very robust research, which shows that Google really favours its own stuff, like Google Maps, Google Images, all these things pop up in a way which doesn't really suggest that it's actually chance or that it's about some fantastic piece of optimization. You know? And I think that Google is going to have to yield on that side. I think the Foundom's case there is pretty well made.
Well, given that Microsoft has also, I mean, Microsoft, it was founded, I believe, this week in 1974, so it's been around for a good long time.
It's 3 months older than I am, in fact.
Yeah, it's not that much older than me either. But given that Microsoft has been through these hoops, these antitrust investigations in the past, what can we expect? Looking at that, Charles, what's going to happen with the Google case?
Well, I think Google has always been very mindful about Microsoft. I mean, one of the things that allowed Google to grow so quickly, so fast, was that in the sort of 2000-2001 period, especially, when it was really starting to gain traction, Microsoft was having a profound cultural shift because it had been found guilty of antitrust infringements in the US. It was having to fight a rearguard action against the Department of Justice to avoid being broken up, which was what Judge Penfield Jackson had recommended in his antitrust findings. So that's sort of 1999, 2000, 2001. There's a big cultural shift going on inside Microsoft saying, oh, no, we have to, you know, it's the electric rail. Don't touch anything that is going to smack of antitrust. And so they basically took their eyes off a lot of balls at that point, and Google just came straight through the middle, was very careful to not come to Microsoft's notice, not to make noises about how profitable the business was or any of that sort of stuff. It's very evident, everything you read at the time. And they then floated and sort of burst out of the water in 2004 with a huge search share, a huge amount of money, and Microsoft couldn't catch them. And it's been trying to play catch-up ever since.
What can Google do to ensure that it doesn't have the same fate when, you know, some young whippersnappers, as they're distracted by these allegations in the US and, you know, potentially in the EC with the British companies, what can they do to make sure that they don't have another somebody coming along and taking their thunder?
It's really difficult. I mean, there's always going to be another startup, and eventually there's going to be a startup who does it better than you or does something that you'd like to do but gets there first. Because that's really what actually Google did to Microsoft, was they did search. Microsoft wanted to do search. They were in 1997 when Google started up. Microsoft was already offering a search engine. It was pretty rubbish. But, you know, they proclaimed it as, hey, we're the greatest, it's the best. Google came along, did it far better, swept them off the board. But that's not where Microsoft's eye was. What Google can do, it's difficult. They have to sort of have a startup mentality, and yet they have to not use powers they have in one area just to influence what happens in another. And that's really difficult to do as you get bigger.
The startup mentality should potentially be something that's natural to the new CEO, given that Larry Page is from the startup culture. He started Google. Jemima, what do you think Larry should do?
He's facing quite a challenge, actually. It's a very big company to the one that it was when he was CEO last time around, which was 10 years ago. It was a tiny little... It was one of the whippersnappers, I suppose. He's not inherently a very sociable person. I don't think he's particularly keen on the press. He doesn't see it as an efficient use of his time. And as an engineer, I think, you know, he likes his time to be measurable and quantifiable. But it's interesting for somebody that's not inherently that social that one of his biggest tasks... I still don't think they're going to be able to do it, but what is increasingly put on their to-do list is coming up with something social. And they've systematically sort of failed, despite numerous efforts now, to do that. Mobile is increasingly looking like one of their strengths, and he will probably be right to focus on that. And it's interesting that both Sergey and Larry pushed against Eric, who didn't want them to introduce Android or Chrome OS. He didn't want them to do the operating systems, and they won that battle, and I think they've been proved right in that. So we may see more engineering-led strategy.
Well, right now the time is quite ripe for pushing something social on mobile, given the most recent figures, isn't that right? Tell us what happened.
It's Comscore research. Right. This is the first 3 months in the US, and basically saw Android's share go up 7% to about 33%, and then BlackBerry second, Apple third, Microsoft and Palm. This has been characterized as Android breaking ahead of Apple, but actually Apple has never said it wanted to be the mainstream, the market leader in mobile, because it's a niche product for a wealthy demographic. So I don't think they'd be too surprised by those results. But also, if you look more closely at the stats, although the Apple share hasn't really changed from the last time they did this research, where Android is really eating in is from BlackBerry, Microsoft and Palm, whose share is all down.
What is going to happen there? Because it is an interesting platform, Android, because historically it's been an open operating system, which has been very attractive, say, to the developing world. And certainly you can see that would be where, you know, their market share would absolutely skyrocket compared with something like RIM, like BlackBerry or even Windows, which are shut down and proprietary. Mm. Why do you think it is, though, that, you know, that this is happening? Is it for this reason or is it for some other reason?
Well, I think people are broadly very interested in smartphones and the Android devices compared to iPhone, which is arguably the highest profile smartphone, are very attractive. You know, they're in some cases less than half the price. The things that are against Google are that Android as a name is quite geeky and most people aren't geeky. So if they really are going to go mainstream, there need to be some kind of softer, fluffier, don't do pink phones, but, you know, kind of heading in a more mainstream direction.
Don't do pink phones.
God's sake, don't do pink phones or I'll boycott anything to do with Android forever.
Furry phones?
Maybe furry phones with legs and feet and, you know, I don't know. Hats, just an idea, throwing it out there. So they do need to head more towards the mainstream, but there's a slight lack of coherence in their identity, precisely because Android is used on so many handsets now. So maybe a little more coherence in what they're offering. But then Google can't retain control over Android because it's open. So,
but
we should see.
At the minute, there has been recently the announcement, the shift, the change in its development environment. Charles, what's been going on there? Is it because they're starting to get so big that they're starting to close down their marketplace? Tell me what's happening there. What's the change?
What Google is doing is something that the signs really are that actually it's something it always wanted to do. So you've had the Android explosion now, where there are now lots and lots of manufacturers in Korea and Taiwan and China and Japan who are making Android handsets. But you have the problem where there are so many handsets that updating the software becomes a problem. So for the carriers, they want to test every update to the software before it goes through them. This happens for every phone. It happens for Apple, it happens for RIM, all of them. So before you get your update from Froyo 2.2 to Gingerbread 2.3, that handset on that carrier and that software has to be tested by the carrier. And if they give it the OK, it goes through. There are so many Android handsets, just becomes impossible. So the carriers say, you know what, we won't bother. And the handset manufacturers say, you know what, we got a new handset coming out next week, so we don't care either. So you have this sort of fragmentation effect. where you have loads and loads of smartphones with very, very different versions of Android. What's happening is that Andy Rubin at Google, who was brought in, they bought his company Android in 2005, and now he is basically closing down on the madness of the whole Android thing. He's saying, okay, guys, we're going to do it in this way. We might not necessarily release the source code straight away, which makes it harder for every mobile manufacturer under the sun to start making Android phones. He's going to be much more controlled about how it's used, how it's implemented. It may be something where some favorites get played, you know, HTC this month, Samsung next month, and it's going to be a much more controlled operation, how Android progresses, because they're really in it, you know, they're in the big game now.
But what effect will this have on the end user? Will this change what types of apps I have access to?
Well, hopefully a bit more coherence on the App Store. God, I mean, there isn't even a web version of Marketplace where you can look at apps and browse them. There's zero promotion.
There's market.android.com.
They finally introduced that.
Is now up and running. But the problem is the fragmentation thing that you've had there, because there was this explosion of handsets. So what it does mean is that you will get, I think, a tighter stream of Android phones, and there won't be one sort of expects there won't be quite the madness. Okay, in China and India, it might be there'll be an absolute explosion again, that you'll get all sorts of things, but it all runs through Google. A lot of people have said, well, this means that it's not open source anymore. This is complete betrayal of Android. Actually, you know, A, it doesn't matter. Does it matter at all? You know, does it really? Did you really build your phone operating system for nothing? Do you do it with your operating system? Do you do it with your browser? Hardly anyone does. These are real, you know, niche things. And for the other thing, the point is that the licenses under which Android was provided were never the sort of the Linux style ones. They're much more the Apache style ones, which are more restrictive. You know, Google owns it. Google knows where it's going.
Well, keep your eye on this smartphone information, all this news at guardian.co.uk/technology. But also in this week's news, Amazon has announced its latest suite of consumer-focused cloud-based software, including the Cloud Player, which is a streaming facility that pulls down the music that you've stored on your small portion of Amazon servers and plays it on any device that is compatible with the service. This seems to me as if it's Amazon's response to the enormously successful Apple iTunes delivery system model, but there has been a very negative response to this service from the music industry. Now, Jemima, why? What's happened here?
Well, it's widely anticipated that Google is going to release a streaming service, and that Apple, who bought Lala, the streaming service, years ago now, is going to come out with its own streaming service. So both of those two are brewing something. Apple has already had quite extensive talks with all four music labels. And what Amazon has done here, and they haven't apparently had any serious talks with music labels, is preempt the launch of both those services and launch into a very interesting, very consumer popular space, because they think that being first is, you know, going to give them a strategic advantage. They argue that because this is effectively a storage service, so, you know, you could take all of your music that you already own and upload it. So therefore, it's not a streaming service in the way that you're sharing and buying music in sort of multiple copies. This is music,
like, for example, Spotify or Pandora or Last.fm.
Yeah, it's not about accessing new music. And that therefore you don't need a license to stream that music. So that's why they've just gone ahead and launched it.
Is it in any way different to, say, for example, I've got a network drive at home. I stick all of my music on my network
exactly
drive.
Or
a
USB
stick.
No, it's exactly how Amazon are describing it. I suspect so that they're starting to build their defence for the court cases that are going to come. And the record industry, although it's relaxing a little bit, certainly compared to the film industry, in its attitude to new services, because it realises now it does actually have to get on board this particular train.
God, how many years is that?
A
train
few.
I thought left the station a long time ago.
Yeah, and most of the labels are still standing on the station. In fact, they haven't even bought their ticket
yet. Bought their tickets. They're waving their cash around.
We are widely anticipating at some point down the road there will be legal action.
But I have to say, I mean, you know, what... If you think about it a bit, what's the value of this? Because, you know, there's a really good service called Pogo Plug, which is a little, it's sort of pinky purple box, right? It's like the P word. But you plug it into your home network, and it will take files off that network, and it will stream them to an internet address that you can choose. You could go and listen to do your whole music collection. You don't need Amazon to be giving you 5 gigabytes, which you sort of have something on.
But it's easier, isn't it? For the traditional normal consumer.
It's not easier. PogoPlug is dead simple.
But Amazon's going for the mainstream. Yeah, they want to take on Apple. They want to take on iTunes, which most people understand how to use and is very tied down and is hard to use in other locations. I've had countless problems copying music collections that I already own, I should say, my iTunes library, when I lost one laptop and then needed to reinstate it on another, and then it was a hard drive, and my music collection has now almost completely been destroyed because it was locked inside iTunes. Suggestions on a postcard.
Oh, geez, don't say that. I did get rid of all my CDs when I
think we used the word backup. Your backup device.
Let's not even go there.
Well, we will have to go there later if we insist on going there. You can hear more on these stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. Hunter Walk is YouTube's inside guy at Google. He's the video services director of product development at the search company. And Jemima, you spoke with him in Austin, Texas at the recent South by Southwest Festival.
Yes, he's a very important person at YouTube, as you said. And after Google bought YouTube, which is actually a horrifyingly near history, even though it seems like YouTube's been around forever, he became the most important person after Chad Hurley and Steve Chen. I started by asking him how YouTube is looking at improving its recommendation tools.
There's sort of three lenses through which we understand the content we care about. There is a water cooler effect. There is, I want to see what the world is talking about. But then at a more personal level, there's both sort of the content that I care about as well as the content my friends are watching. And so to successfully navigate both of those areas, we've had to really do a lot of hard work on the content that I care about. There's sort of two techniques. The first is helping you tell us what you care about, right? So, for example, being able to subscribe to and follow different content creators on the site. So finally, I also mentioned what your friends are watching. And that's an interesting signal for us. It's not necessarily always a suggestion of that content is relevant to you, but it's almost more about the conversation around that content.
Well, the conversation is really interesting because YouTube's comments are, you know, notoriously bad. And although there is a way of voting up and down and, you know, reporting, should we say comments that aren't that constructive? The quality is often quite poor, and it does, you know, even on quite good videos. What more can you do to, I suppose, really encourage a more constructive engagement with people? Because I think it's the lack of a specific community, again, that contributes to that.
It's incremental. We made some small changes over the last year, for example, where the highest rated comments surface to the top, as well as we've increasingly focused on what we call conversations, which would be when the uploader is responding to a comment. Mm-hmm. So the act of the video creator engaging with the audience is both, I think, a good signal for that is interesting and relevant to the video owner, mm-hmm. As well as I think helps to create a sense that this isn't just a video, this is a person behind this video. And part of YouTube is not just about the lean back, press play, and watch it, but it's about being able to interact with those creators. So over time, I really do want to continue to evolve that part of the site to foster but also pull in the best conversations about that video from not just on YouTube, but from across the web. Mm.
This idea of the conversation as well, I hate to mention Facebook, but the number of YouTube videos on Facebook is pretty impressive, and there's always a really lively conversation about that. So is there more ways in which you could integrate Facebook conversations?
Oh, and you shouldn't hate to mention, I think, Facebook, our goal is to be a promiscuous publisher of YouTube activity to anywhere that people go to answer the question, what should I pay attention to? What are my friends are doing? We see more than 400 tweets a minute that include a YouTube link. More than 150 years worth of YouTube video are watched on Facebook every day, which is, while that's it's still a small percentage of overall YouTube traffic, but an amazing number in and of itself. And so I look at all of that as, you know, as success. Video has always been social, and some of that interaction will occur on YouTube, but, you know, that interaction will occur around the web as well. And so we can actually also look at your graph within those spaces and pull the relevant YouTube videos back to the YouTube homepage. So what that means is you can come to youtube.com as a logged in user, you've created an account, and you've hooked up your Facebook account, you've subscribed to a lot of different YouTube channels as well. So not only can we show you the content from your friends that you've subscribed to on YouTube, but we can look at your Facebook newsfeed, look for other references to YouTube videos, and show you those at YouTube as well. Because ultimately what I want to do is make sure that YouTube is the best place to go to answer the question, what should I watch? And what are my friends watching is often an important signal to answer that question.
Related to this idea of communities, there was a really interesting project that Google and YouTube did with the Guggenheim to try and encourage experimental art and exploratory kind of video art. And that was a really interesting and very very focused use of YouTube. What more can you do to promote the really good quality stuff?
What we've seen a lot of success and increasingly are investing in is enabling a curator class of people to help mine through that content on the site and expose some of that diversity. Let's say I wanted to put together a playlist of 20 wonderful tilt shift stop motion animation videos, you know, something very, very interesting and web-like. On one hand, you can imagine a Google solution that says, well, let's build an algorithm and we'll analyze, you know, the hundreds of millions of videos and we'll rank them and we'll come out with the perfect 20. And on the other hand, you might imagine, you know, a totally human approach which says, we'll hire an art editor. And that art editor, with their great taste in fashion, will be able to look through the site and they'll pick the 20 best videos. And actually, although we use aspects of both of those techniques, neither is sort of the perfect approach. What we've seen is one great way is to look at where are those videos being played or talked about. And so, for example, using things like the Google Web Search Corpus, we know what the most relevant art sites are. And if you look at what YouTube videos they're embedding or linking to, you get a very interesting curated set of content that the masses essentially curated. Frankly, one of our challenges right now, I think, is we haven't created a great browse model for YouTube. Yeah. And we already see about half of our queries are what we'd call broad queries. They're not looking for a particular video. They're looking for a set of videos. They're looking for an experience. Examples like funny videos or Barcelona. Like, yeah. They're not looking literally for a video titled Barcelona. They're saying, I'm going to Barcelona or I'm in Barcelona. Show me a bunch of content that I might be interested in that is relevant to my location. Mm. And what we need to do there, I think, is come up with an experience that's less about, you know, a force-ranked list of links and more about sets of content, more about being able to analyze that content and say, well, here's Barcelona museum videos.
What's on your to-do list and what can we expect in the next 12 months, say?
Absolutely. So moving what I think of as the atomic unit of the site from a single video to sets or collections of video. So this goes to the programming, the publishing tools that we want to give content creators, as well as the curation experience. So right now, for example, you can build a playlist on the site, but it's kind of clunky to do that, and it's really hard to add your context. What you're essentially doing is just stringing together a bunch of videos, but you're not able to add anything to that as a curator that says, hey, this is why I think these videos are interesting, or if I'm building a playlist that says top 10 live performances of the Grateful Dead, or here are my favorite recipe videos. You're not able to annotate them in a way that says, this was really good, but it's even better. Instead of using raisins, if you use dried cranberries, it's just delicious, right? So giving the average user more tools to collect the videos that they care most about, create sets out of them, put some context around, and then share that as a unit where the viewer can see not just the video itself, but the context alongside that. We often say, I sometimes joke with my team that in our desire and the opportunity with mobile phones and high quality video, all these things, that over the last year we focused a lot on the tube and not as much on the you. And now this year we have to sort of reverse that a little bit and remember that ultimately at the end of the day what we have are people creating video for people. And so what we want to do is create more and more tools that allow those people to create and connect.
That was Hunter Walk from Google, the head guy of YouTube. Now, Jemima, he spent a lot of time there talking about the social graph. Right? He spent, and I find that a particularly terrifying concept when it comes to the development of new tools and technologies that we interact with. Mm. But isn't YouTube simply just the modern public access channel, like in the States we have things that spawned, that inspired things like Wayne's World, or back in the day Weird Al Yankovic's UHF. I mean, is there anything that YouTube does that is any different from that kind of thing? that they can apply a social graph to?
It's so vast, its scale is so big that there are multiple communities from slightly dodgy adult-orientated things.
To
a huge amount of really mediocre stuff. But there is some really interesting, there are really interesting pockets on YouTube. And the project I mentioned in there, the Guggenheim project, went some way to try and promoting that. Google is not really best placed to be a cultural or creative curator of content, but there are these pockets there, and because of the scale, people see it as the first point of call to put their video when they make something. Hunter did say there that of the two traditional methods of curating, there's the kind of Google approach, which is a mechanized approach, like the most people watch this video, therefore we're recommending it to you. Or there's a kind of editorial approach where you sit someone who's an expert down and they pick out stuff they think is really good and recommend it. It was interesting that he was talking about a third way, which is where are these videos that are popular being played? And that goes some way to reflecting the communities that they're part of and the people that are picking up on them.
What's nice about that also is that it's not just focusing on a walled garden. It's not saying it happens within YouTube. He was talking about how it you know goes out into Facebook and Twitter and all of those other things. So it looks almost...
Yes, he mentioned the F word.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned the F word, frankly, Jemima.
Okay, but he said we shouldn't be afraid to mention it, is what he said.
Charles, now they're clearly not as interested in inspiring productive communities. Jemima did mention in there that, you know, looking at the comments, and you can just see a kind of cesspool of depravity and just general flame wars that happen. But I mean, is this a problem? And do you think that they should try and fix it, or should they focus on the broader web community and how they fit into social groups elsewhere on the web?
You know, if you could fix the comments on YouTube, you would have fixed the internet.
I think it is in their interest to fix them. You know, they don't want those bad comments to be up, and they have introduced those voting systems. But, you know, maybe they should do that thing where somebody whose IP is flagged up as being a repeatedly aggressive user, they'll sort of deteriorate the experience that they get. So all the videos will load slowly, or they won't see the responses to their own comments or something.
The problem with IP-based stuff is that it doesn't scale well, because you get lots of people, say, from AOL, who there are still a lot of users or who come through a single one.
Well, they frankly deserve
and
to
ISPs,
have a
burn. Well, you know, but I mean... I think actually the model that Slashdot has been using for years and years is by far the better one, where, you know, stuff gets modded up and down, and Slashdot's a pretty big community. It's pretty disparate. You get some very reasonable people there and some possibly less reasonable people there, and you know, I think that's actually the best model. I don't quite know why they haven't followed that.
Jemima,
I think the biggest challenge and the most interesting thing to observe about how YouTube develops will be how much they allow and encourage the site to develop off-site, so in third-party ways. And I mentioned there that video is very popular on YouTube, but if they were clever, they'd want it to be the default video player across the web. And they do need to overhaul that site in some way, which has changed very, very little since it launched and feels quite out of date now. What could they do with the enormous resources and insight that they have to make that video site really go up a level?
So it's a crack team of designers need to swoop in and take over and make it look prettier.
Yeah, and sort of strategists and people with insight into how people use social media and how those communities could be better represented. I just feel like there's a big opportunity for YouTube in presenting it, I suppose, slightly more editorially.
Well, you can read up more on YouTube and, of course, on all of the South by Southwest coverage at guardian.co.uk and specifically /South by Southwest. Well, that's it for this week. Many thanks to our studio guests, Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur. As always, it is a pleasure to have the Dream Team back together.
Do I get to keep the William and Catherine mug?
You need to put that down. It's absolutely hideous.
Okay, but it's fine bone china.
It's a suitable enough vessel that you could have a large coffee in that. And for that, I accept
it's a vessel.
It's absolutely hideous. So it will not be in the studio next week. This week's podcast was produced by Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Kratosky. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.